Fasten your seatbelts and brace yourself for a descent into terror. It's January 31st, 2000, 4:21 PM PST, Alaska Airlines Flight 261 lifts off from the sun-drenched beaches of Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Carrying 88 souls, passengers and crew alike, towards an anticipated arrival in Seattle. But in a heartbeat, sunshine surrenders to screams. The once peaceful plane contorts violently, a horrifying rollercoaster ride, unfolding thousands of feet above the Pacific Ocean. The once calm canvas below transforms into a terrifying expanse of rushing water, growing ever closer with each agonizing moment. Amidst the chaos, skilled pilots fight a silent war against a hidden gremlin lurking within the aircraft's controls. Their every action becomes a desperate gamble, a race against time and an invisible enemy. Will their experience and skill be enough to overcome this unforeseen crisis and save everyone on board? Tune in to the Flight Files and discover the harrowing story of Alaska Airlines Flight 261, a cautionary tale of mechanical failure and the unwavering courage of those who faced it head on. Hello listeners, welcome back to the Flight Files. My name is Tom and I'm joined today by my co-host Dan.
Hi Tom.
Hello Dan, how are you?
I'm good thanks, how are you?
Yes, not too bad. What do you think?
So, hidden gremlin. This is interesting. So, and you also mentioned it's a mechanical failure. So I'm intrigued. I'm not too familiar with the McDonnell Douglas aircraft. So I'm excited for this one.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a very interesting story. We'll obviously get into the details straight away. So just a little bit of background context. Alaska Airlines were founded in 1932 and a respected carrier, regional carrier, known for its safety records. As you mentioned, the flight was operated on a McDonnell Douglas MD-83, which was, in its time, a workhorse of the commercial aviation industry, which first entered service in 1980. So it's a sort of, you're probably familiar with the shape, the sort of engines are fitted on the back, and it's got the T tail. Have you sort of seen that? Sort of
yes, style jet? Yeah. So similar to like the sort of smaller jet styles that you see.
Yeah, like the regional ones, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, background-wise, so the part of the aircraft that we're going to be focusing on the most is the back wing, so that T tail that I just mentioned. And for anyone who's unfamiliar, the back section of the aircraft features a vertical fin, which is that upright bit, which gives the aircraft a yaw control via the rudder, the pedals that the pilots can push. So that swings the aircraft right or left. So this T-tail configuration is a bit different to what we see now, these days. Most aircraft these days have a sort of the horizontal section is fitted a bit lower down. The horizontal stabilizer on the MD-83 is mated on top of the vertical stabilizer because of sort of where the engines are mated and how the wings are placed. That's just where it's better designed to be. However, there are a few drawbacks to that T-tail, so it sort of can cause deep stalls because the engines don't provide any sort of rushing air over the control surface like a normal configuration would do, so that's just a little point of maybe why they've changed. And the vertical stabilizer has to be much more stronger to support the weight of the horizontal bit.
Because the planes are bigger. Because you said 88 passengers? for this?
Yes.
Or 88 people total?
Yep.
Whereas commercial jets, like Airbus and Boeing, carry, you know, more than double.
Hundreds. Exactly, yeah. So you can imagine that that horizontal bit is mated on top of the vertical stabilizer. So that vertical stabilizer has got to be very strong.
Yeah.
So you can save weight by moving the horizontal stabilizer down and not having to have such a strong vertical one. As I said, the horizontal stabilizer. So what does that do if you're unfamiliar? Essentially, it controls the pitch axis of the plane. So that's nose up or down. And it can be used in two ways. So either the pilot pushes the yoke, so his control column in front of him, he pushes that forward or back. Forward to put the nose down, back to put the nose up. Or the pilots can do what's called trimming. So that actually moves the whole horizontal stabilizer. So when they pull the yoke back, that only moves an elevator, just a little part of the wing. Whereas when they trim it, the whole thing moves. It's much more impactful on the pitch. But it's used to sort of keep the plane level during flight. As the weight changes, the autopilot trims the plane. And yeah, that's sort of what it's used for. Is that all right, Dan?
Yeah, no, sounds good to me.
Okay. So there's an important piece in the horizontal stabilizer, the jack screw. So that's like a big screw, and basically a motor turns it. And if it spins one way, the horizontal stabilizer moves up, and if it spins the other way, it moves down. It's very similar to like a car jack tire. A car tire jack, sorry. So, you know, like that sort of jack screw.
Yeah.
So you screw it, the jack extends upwards. So that sort of similar thing. Just as a bit of a visual. So, yeah, that screw and nut mechanism. So the screw, the nut the screw runs through has a service life of 30,000 hours. And is actually made to be a softer material than the screw, so the screw would not wear. Which I thought was quite interesting, quite clever.
Yeah, so that means that the screw would not. Does that mean it would all last longer because of the screw wouldn't wear as much?
Yeah, so the nut would take the wear, and you'd be able to change the nut.
Yeah.
At a service interval. However, shortly after certification of the aircraft, higher wear was actually found. So inspections were put in place. So quite early on, we're talking sort of, to begin with, every 350 flight hours, the assembly was sort of inspected. But this reduced ultimately to every 8 months when they would start implementing sort of greasing schedules, because obviously you can imagine you've got two mechanical parts that move in each other. You need to have grease so they move freely. If they're dry, then they're going to start binding against each other and scratching and wearing each other. So
yeah.
Grease is extremely important. That'll come into play down the line. Maybe. And on that greasing, just quickly, the maintenance procedure for doing the grease is expected to last 4 hours. But after the incident, some of the workers were interviewed and said that it would take them around an hour.
So they were spending 3 hours less than what it was supposed to?
Boeing suggested that it took 4 hours. The maintenance staff said it took them an hour, so something's not quite adding up there.
No. This was I wonder if they were. This is just a theory that were they cost cutting, trying to speed up the process to save costs, get the aircraft out quicker.
Quite possibly, yeah. Maybe, or maybe it was just sort of they thought they were doing everything that they needed to.
Yeah.
Mistraining, maybe. Yeah, we'll get into a little bit later on anyway. So, the last sort of maintenance importance thing, this is quite a maintenance-heavy topic. Boeing suggested that wear checks were carried out, so using special tooling, checking the rate of wear on the components every 30 months or 7,200 hours. And Alaska Airlines took that and said, okay, we're just going to do it every 30 months. We're not going to worry about hours.
Right.
And
okay.
Ultimately, you know, with schedules and trying to make as much money out of their aircraft, it was calculated that they were doing sort of 9,500 hours every 30 months.
Quite significantly over the recommended.
Yes.
It's indeed. it's like a car service, right? Like you do it every 12 months or 10,000 miles, whichever comes first, really.
Exactly like that, yeah. But it's like you saying, okay, I'm not going to do it every 12 months. I'm going to wait till I've done 15,000 miles. And in that, you know, 5,000 miles where you should have had it done, something happens.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the sort of background. So you've got a general idea of where we are. Maintenance is going to come into play a lot.
Yeah.
So, unless you've got any comments.
It sounds like it's going to be a failure of the screw and nut. That's where I think the failure is. I have a feeling that they weren't able to. Because if it comes loose, or if it just breaks, there's no control on that vertical fin and the horizontal stabilizer. So that's what I think happened. That's my theory from the information I have so far.
Yep. Okay. You're on the right lines, definitely. So we get to the incident. So flight 261 was just a regular routine passenger flight from, you know, popular vacation destination in Mexico to a major West Coast city, San Francisco. The MD-83, which was registration November 96 3 Alpha Sierra, was just under 8 years old before the crash. The plane had 26,584 flight hours and 14,315 cycles. As you've mentioned before, Dan, a cycle representing one takeoff and landing.
Yeah. That's a lot of flight hours. For an 8-year-old plane, yeah. That seems quite a lot.
Well, I actually seen. It's funny you've mentioned that. I actually seen when I was doing some research, a comment saying that although it looks a lot, it is actually quite sort of normal.
Oh, okay.
So there were no sort of outstanding issues known with the aircraft. The flight before, many previous flights before, no sort of drastic problems, a pretty normal plane, pretty normal flight.
I suppose that actually only works out to about, I just did the math, 138 days a year over the 8 years. So less than half a year.
Yeah.
So
yeah, if you put it like that, exactly.
Okay, yeah, the number, the 26,000, definitely sounds a lot more than it actually is, I suppose.
Yeah. So on board were 88 people. That includes 2 pilots, 3 flight attendants, and the 83 passengers. In the cockpit, we have Captain Ted Thompson, who was an ex-Air Force pilot. He was aged 53 at the time and was an incredibly experienced pilot with 17,715 total flying hours, 4,150 of which were as a pilot in command on the MD-80 family. So, you know, this guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And similarly, on his right-hand side, his first officer, Bill Tanksky, also had previous military experience, but with the US Navy. He was 57 and had 8,140 hours, with a total of 8,060 on the MD-80 family.
So really experienced with the MD-80 family then.
So yeah, he sort of knew this plane inside out, I guess. Yeah. Whereas Ted had general flying knowledge.
I wonder what would be classed as better, like in incidents like this. Like, would you be more beneficial having a variety of experience across different aircraft, or knowing the ins and outs of one plane family in particular?
That's a very good point, actually. I do wonder what would be more sort of advantageous. I guess maybe it comes down to the fault that you see.
I suppose, yeah, because it might be different across different planes, but you might be able to identify it more quickly if you're familiar with the aircraft, yeah.
If you know the system that's faulted, like the back of your hand, or if it's just like a sort of general plane fault, then I guess maybe that would help you in that situation. But that's luck of the dice, I guess, isn't that?
Yeah.
So yeah, 2 very, very experienced pilots. As I mentioned, the plane had no history of problems that were documented. And on the day, First Officer Bill was the pilot flying for the outbound trip, and Ted was going to return it back. So we get to the flights. Takeoff and initial climb, the plane was an absolute dream, sort of no problems. However, unknown to the pilots, back at that horizontal stabilizer we talked about, over the sort of last several thousand hours, the screw had actually begun to grind on the softer threads of the nut and began to wear considerably, with little to no grease on the components. Obviously, it's not going to do that system any good.
No.
So, yeah, completely unknown at the minute. The pilots climbed to 23,500 feet, where suddenly the horizontal stabilizer actually stopped responding to the autopilot and also the pilot's commands. So they tried to sort of manually trim the autopilot. Wasn't able to trim, it was as if it was sort of jammed. The pilots recognised quickly that their sort of pitch control was unresponsive, but they, at this time in time, they were couldn't figure out why exactly. So they were actually unable to sort of stabilise the aircraft at this point. It was sort of not doing what they expected it to. The jammed stabilizer we just talked about prevented the use of that trim system, which I said before would allow small adjustments to the control of the pitch. So the pilots actually discussed at this point diverting back to Los Angeles, as they were sort of quite close. They were only at 23,000 feet, so they were probably only 15-20 minutes away. And they actually used the yoke to maintain their climb. And interestingly, I've seen a point saying that First Officer Bill would have been pulling back with 22 kilos of force, which is 50 pounds, just to keep the plane sort of in its position.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so they obviously knew something wasn't right, but the plane was flying in a sort of, not stabilised, but stabilised sort of way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it was still doing its job. They just weren't sure why it wasn't doing it by itself.
Yeah, exactly. So you may also be thinking, Dan, that why didn't they just turn back straight away? And to answer that, they would have been overweight because of the fuel that they had. They would have had higher approach and landing speeds. And as I've just said, the problem doesn't seem too bad at the minute. They've got something wrong, but they're still flying. They're still climbing. Everything doesn't seem too bad at the minute. So maybe that's why they didn't decide to divert straight away.
Yeah, I suppose maybe reached their cruise altitude and diagnosed then. Maybe that's what they were thinking.
Yeah, so exactly. So that's what they actually did. They continued their climb up to 31,000 feet. They reached 31,000 feet, and the force needed was significantly reduced on the yoke, and yeah, the flight sort of became a lot more normal. Only a slight bit of force was needed because of their speed and their height. That force had sort of reduced. They were no longer climbing. And the flight actually carried on for another 2 hours. When I seen that, I was like, damn. It must have been actually pretty normal.
So were they still... would they have had to have manually flown it? Or would autopilot have kicked in?
No, that was fully manually.
Oh, okay. So pretty... full on then, like more mentally exhausted.
Yeah, definitely have to, not just sort of as everyone thinks, sitting there and watching the world go by. I guess they definitely had to focus, try and troubleshoot the problem, contact maintenance department, see what information they can get. But yeah, as soon as that sort of first instance happened, where the autopilot couldn't activate the trim, they disconnected it and they didn't re-engage it because they didn't know what the autopilot might try and do.
Yeah, true. Because if it didn't input that they weren't expecting, or just wasn't lining up with whatever failure they were dealing with, I suppose it could have ended in disaster.
Exactly that. As I just mentioned, they contacted maintenance. Maintenance checked through all sort of reports, aircraft status. Found nothing wrong with the aircraft. But the pilots were definitely not happy with this. Something was definitely wrong. They didn't know what was in store, but they weren't feeling confident about the aircraft they were flying and the safety of everyone on board. It was obviously a major majorly important thing. So they actually notified their operations team that they wanted to divert to Los Angeles instead of going to San Francisco. Obviously, the two are very close, so you may be thinking, why would they want to go to Los Angeles? Well, one, it was closer. Two, the weather was actually better, so it would have made their approach a little easier.
Some more favourable conditions.
Yeah, given the circumstance of their conditions that they were in, exactly.
Okay, and where were they coming from? Because you said they was they were going to return to LAX. Was it Mexico?
Yes.
They were coming from?
Yeah, Puerto Vallarta. I don't know if I'm saying that right. I'm saying it how it looks.
Yeah.
But yeah, sort of holiday destination in Mexico. So, pilots told their operations team that this is what they wanted to do. They're not quite happy. And amazingly, the operations team weren't too happy about that, which I find incredible.
Yeah, why is that?
You got two pilots 31,000 feet up in the air saying that they've got flight control problems or potential flight control problems they need to divert. And it's the sort of pressure where they're saying, oh yeah, no, that's fine, you can do it, but just remember, this will delay your sort of outbound flight back home. Other flights will be delayed by this. We'll have to pay a fee to get into Los Angeles. That's the sort of responses that the operations team are giving back to the pilots.
So, concerns about money instead of safety.
Yeah. Crazy to me.
Yeah, but absolutely. Like, if you know, two pilots with combined flight hours of almost 20,000 hours, or over 20,000 hours, are telling you we need to divert closer, you listen to them.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not... It affects the pilots too. Do you know what I mean? They don't want to divert.
Yeah.
Because it messes up their day. These guys are... If they're doing a 4-hour flight, say, they're doing 4 hours there, 4 hours back, and they're back home where they can rest. If they've got to divert, then they're not home.
Yeah.
So, it's not something that they want to do. It's something that they felt they had to do.
Yeah. So, it's amazing that they were basically told, you can do it, but all of this. Remember money.
Exactly. So the pilots actually descended in their wisdom to descend and sort of see how the aircraft behaves. If they can, you know, descend, configure the aircraft a little bit, slow it down, deploy some flats and some slats, flaps, maybe the gear, you know, see how the flight control issues are at that point, and then they'll make a decision whether they need to go quickly emergency into Los Angeles or they can make it to San Francisco, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best thing to do in the circumstance.
Yeah. The other point at this as well, they're actually flying over the Pacific Ocean at the minute. So, you know, they're not endangering anyone on the ground. If stuff does go bad, they've kept themselves out of the way. They need to diagnose what's going on with their plane to keep themselves safe and, you know, civilians on the ground safe at the same time, which I think is, you know, in the heat of the moment, it's actually quite incredible when you think of it.
Yeah, it's a consideration that many might not make in an event of a potential issue with an aircraft.
Yeah, definitely. So the as I said, they were back and forth of maintenance and operations, asking sort of what they can do. And the maintenance, you know, really wanted to stress, have they sort of tried everything with this, with the trim? So have they pressed all of the buttons that they can do? Have they pressed the cutout switches? Have they pressed the standby switches? Have they tried pressing two together? All this. And the pilots had actually done this all anyway. They're experienced, they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They had tried everything that the maintenance was sort of telling them. But I think this sort of, not nagging, but sort of going on by the maintenance team sort of put a little bit of doubt in the pilots' minds, maybe. And they wanted to just check it once more. See if they could get it to move or free it up. So they actually pressed two buttons together. They pressed the one on the yoke, the little, I think they're called pickle switches. And they actually pressed the one near the thrust levers. I think that's called like a suitcase trim switch. They pushed them together. And a loud thump could actually be heard on the CVR, the cockpit voice recorder, as they did this action.
Oh.
This loud thump was then followed by a nosedive of the aircraft, which suggested sort of, you know, extensive failure of the stabilizer. It was actually fully deflected in one direction, so it was fully deflected up to a nose down position. It was the only thing that was keeping it there now was a mechanical stop. And at this point, the pilots contacted ATC, telling them that they're in a dive. Now, there is actually recordings of this available. Possibly something that we can link to on the website.
Yeah, if you want to check out all the links from these episodes, they'll be included in the I don't know what it's called, a link dump, I guess. Or if you head on over to theflightfiles.com, you'll be able to see all the episodes there and all the links that we're referring to.
Yeah, so now the plane was in a full nosedive. the pilots actually deployed the speed brake because they were in a nosedive. They wanted to try and slow the aircraft down. And pulled back on the yoke with now around 60 kilograms or 130 pounds of force. So, you know, they're in a dive, they're desperately sort of pulling back on their flight controls.
With everything they've got, by the sounds of it.
With everything, yeah, with everything they've got, exactly. 60 kilograms is about 10 stone, if you work in stone. So, yeah, a lot of force required to get this plane back out of a dive, which they actually did.
They managed it.
So yeah, they dropped 3,000, not 3,000, sorry. They dropped to 24,000 feet, where they managed to stabilize the plane back into level flight. I'm not quite sure if they were continuously pulling back right now, or if the force reduced. I would imagine the force would have reduced a little bit. Maybe, or they might have been, you know, fully flat out here, pulling back to keep it level. I'm not actually sure on that. If they were, that's insane.
Yeah, to consistently be able to do that.
Yeah, and talk to ATC.
So much going on.
Exactly. So they, you know, after that event, they requested a what's called a block altitude clearance. So they requested to ATC that they're a bit uncontrollable at the minute. can we sort of be cleared between one altitude and another altitude? To which ATC said, of course you can, you know, you're not doing too well at the minute, so stay between these altitudes and just sort of get back to me with any problems. So, yeah, and another point, the captain actually declined a direct to the airport, to LAX at this point. ATC said, do you want to come direct? And he said, no, we need to sort of figure out what we're doing, what the plane's doing. We don't want to come, like I said earlier, we don't want to come closer to land and then something catastrophic happening. So they just stayed out over the Pacific, over the open water, so they could test the systems on their damaged plane, which again, as I said, I think is quite remarkable, really, in their circumstances.
Yeah, they're really trying to figure out what's gone wrong.
Yeah. So yeah, they continue to try and figure out what's going wrong, and by me saying continue to figure out what's going wrong, they're sort of talking to their maintenance team, operations, asking what it could be. I mean, they've tried everything, but they're just asking for some advice. They actually asked ATC if there were any training pilots available that they could chat to that, you know, might have experience of this. They're basically requesting help from really experienced pilots, but unfortunately there was none available. And yeah, while they were actually trying to configure the aircraft between that block altitude at approximately 17,000 feet, a few quiet bangs and thumps could be heard and felt through the aircraft. And again, the pilots needed to pull really hard on the control column, pull really hard back. And a few seconds later after that, the plane just enters an almost vertical dive, with other aircraft in the areas reporting that the Alaska MD-83 had gone into, you know, a vertical nosedive now towards the ocean.
Oh, God.
So that happens, you know, all within a sort of 5 second space of time. The few quiet bangs, thumps, really need to pull back and then just totally uncontrollable, full nosedive. So the screw that had been used to raise and lower the stabilizer, like I mentioned earlier, that had actually sheared in two pieces now. So nothing was holding it in its place. It was just flapping around in the wind, basically, and it moved so violently into that pitch down position that it actually broke the top part of it off, and it was way past wherever it was designed to be. It's gone through mechanical stops. It was past whatever the instruments could read. But miraculously, the pilots did not give up. They tried to regain control of their crippled jet. And, you know, we're talking about experience here. The captain, thinking on the spot, sort of just out of nowhere, instead of trying to pull up, he actually decided to push down.
So he pushes
his yoke as far forward as he can go, and he actually rolls the aircraft. I don't know if it was to the left or to the right, but he rolled it one way. And he's actually now totally inverted the aircraft, Dan.
No way. Because you didn't mention in the intro if what happened.
No.
So I'm actually on the edge of my seat right now. This is okay. So the plane is fully like upside down.
So they were in a full nosedive. All the forces were pushing the plane downwards. So in that split moment, you got to remember they're at 17,000 feet. They cannot waste a single second.
Yeah.
The pilot, captain has just decided to fully turn the plane on its side and get inverted. That means now that the forces that were pushing it down are actually pushing it up.
This is this going to be like they fly to LAX upside down and then he just does a quick 180 just as they come to land?
It's insane, isn't it? That's I couldn't believe mental. It when I seen it.
And it well, of course, it's just going to push it up, isn't it? If it's locked in the position that is forcing it down.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, just some stats. The pitch actually decreased from negative 70 degrees downwards towards the ocean to negative 9 while they were inverted. So it completely saved them and gave them some time.
But what... I wonder what the passengers must have been thinking. Because all of a sudden they're going down and then they're upside down.
It's just mental. To be fair as well, I think the pilots actually briefed the cabin crew to, you know, get everyone sat down, belted in.
Seatbelts on, yeah.
Before they started doing their configuration tests.
They seem to be really, really conscious and concerned about the passengers and crew on board, which is obviously, I would assume all pilots are, but it seems like an extra level of care.
Yeah, I would agree. There is that whole new level of sort of care and fighting their duty until they can't fight anymore sort of thing.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the military sort of experience they had kind of shining through.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Oh no.
The loss of altitude that they experienced during the dive and their inverted position was actually beyond recovery. But still, the pilots never gave up. They actually tried bringing the plane from its inverted position by kicking the rudder. Again, they're completely inverted at this point. So they're trying to push pedals that are now on the ceiling.
Yeah.
And yeah, when they started trying to do this, roll back over, wings level, both engines actually stalled because of the extreme angle of the air that was now hitting them. It's not a normal position for a commercial jet to be in. So both engines stalled, which obviously led to a loss of lift, speed, and I think that sealed the fate for Alaska Airlines Flight 261. The captain's last words could actually be heard on the CVR, where he said, "Ah, here we go." And then, less than a second later, the aircraft plunged into the ocean, killing everyone on board instantly due to blunt force impact.
Oh, God.
So, again, they fought till the absolute last second. And yeah, that was the incident, Dan.
That was a roller coaster. Because it was. Oh, that's so sad. And those last words as well. It's such a shame because they tried everything they could, and yeah, I feel like the mechanical team and the operations team, their negligence might have been the reason. The maintenance negligence caused it.
Yeah.
And
so we'll
yeah.
If we just, you know, sort of wrap it up with that investigation aftermath sort of section. At the time of the incident, sort of several other aircraft in the vicinity actually witnessed and reported the aircraft going into a steep dive and watched it crash into the Pacific. You can hear on the ATC recordings one pilot actually reporting it. Yeah, it's quite intense, actually.
Yeah, I bet.
However, this did actually help rescue and investigations teams identify the crash site quickly, and it only took a week to salvage most of the important parts. So, cockpit voice recorder, black box, the jack screw assembly of that horizontal stabilizer, and the NTSB, I think it's the National Travel Safety Board.
Transportation Safety Board?
Transportation Safety Board, that's the one. They found the stabilizer assembly, like I just said. And on initial inspection, were shocked to see that the nut that the screw ran in was actually, the inside of it was completely smooth.
From where the screw had been rubbing against it?
Yeah, so all those threads inside the nut had basically been completely worn away. There was almost no resemblance that thing should have had threads on it. The screw had also had, so the actual screw, so if you just picture a general screw, you've got the swirly bits. Those had sort of sheared off and were sort of still wrapped around the metal core. So they were thinking maybe that was why it sort of jammed in the first case. You know where I said that they had that small dive, but then it stopped?
Yeah.
Then maybe they're thinking that's what happened there. But I think the biggest shock to the investigations team was the complete lack of grease on the screw and nut. The grease fitting was clogged with old dirty grease, and the rest of the components were completely dry. Not one bit of grease on them. So the investigators also interviewed maintenance manuals and sort of the teams who were carrying them out, how they were being carried out. There were also things like management positions which had not been filled, like director of maintenance. There was actually no one in that post for 2 years. It was just being shared by two people doing extra duties, which is crazy.
Well, yeah, because they're not going to... They can't focus on that role.
No. I think I seen as well the director of safety had also... He was also a director of something else at the same time. So he can't concentrate on what needs to be done.
No.
Yeah. Like we said before, the car analogy... Alaska Airlines actually had extended their maintenance intervals, which led to excessive wear and tear. So they weren't maintaining it as they should have, which led to wear. So the aftermath, and we should all learn by these incidents, as tragic as they are, we need to sort of make sure that the industry gets safer. So this actually led to 24 safety recommendations by the NTSB. stricter maintenance regulations sort of come in place. There was a renewed focus on the importance of preventative maintenance. Now, I can sort of comment on that coming from a maintenance background. You know, when you don't maintain equipment, especially mechanical equipment, it fails. It's plain and simple. Mechanical things cause friction. They need to be greased. If they're not, then they're going to wear. You know, and that needs to be tracked and looked at and monitored, reported. So yeah, that was a, you know, quite a big point to me, the preventive maintenance side of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was also clear guidance for pilots not to try and repeat functions when they had sort of suspected faults with the horizontal stabilizer, because it is like a primary control surface. So if they are, you know, in doubt, then they need to have serious sort of considerations on what the next steps are. Alaska Airlines also changed their lubrication schedules down to 650 hours. And this was a, you know, a nice one to finish on. Both pilots were posthumously awarded with the Airline Pilots Association Gold Medal for Heroism as a recognition for their heroic actions that took place on that day.
Definitely deserving of that.
Yeah, 100% agree. And again, yeah, these podcasts serve as an information tool and, you know, a way of looking at these stories from different perspectives. Me and Dan have got different perspectives on things. So yeah, they're always interesting, but also, again, always potentially sad in the loss of life. So, you know, it is important to sort of remember that 88 people's lives were lost on that day.
Yeah, and you know, with every incident, the as tragic as they are, they help to make the aviation industry safer, and it is the, you know, safest form of transport, flying.
Yeah, 100% agree, Dan. So yeah, that was that. My closing remark, just a little sort of fun fact, I guess. So, some of you may recognise the sort of series of events that happened in this incident, and that could possibly be because a 2020 film called Flight was actually loosely inspired by the events that took place on Alaska Airlines Flight 261.
Oh.
I don't know if you've seen Flight, Dan, with Denzel Washington.
No, I haven't.
Well, maybe you need to go and watch.
I might have to give it a watch.
You'll see the sort of, you'll see the similarities jump out at you. Trust me. But yeah, have you got any final questions, Dan?
No, I don't. I don't think so. That's a. I was. At the start, I was a bit. I just assumed that it was going to end in disaster. And then you gave me hope when you said they kept fighting. And it's incredible that they managed to do as much as they did, given the circumstance and the amount of force needed to make some of those maneuvers is absolutely incredible. And I have no doubt that their military background definitely helped with some of the decision making that was involved in this.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it was sort of important to stress that fight that they didn't give up. That wasn't just a crash. You know, the plane sort of failed them, and they just accepted their fate. They did try and do everything they could, which is, yeah, incredible, really.
Yeah, you could have very easily just accepted the vertical dive and, you know, just not try anything.
Switched off, panicked.
Yeah. It's incredible. I can't believe it. But that was really interesting. I've not heard of this incident before. And it's really, really interesting how it played out.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you enjoyed the story. Sorry it didn't go quite the way you wanted it.
No, but I mean, we want every flight to be take off and land, right?
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah.
But
that is true.
No, that was really interesting. If you want to find out some more about the podcast, or if you're interested in some of the blog stuff that we're going to be doing, you can head on over to theflightfiles.com. That's where the links will all be. And also, it'd be great if you could leave a follow on your podcast platform of choice, whatever that may be.
Agreed.
We also don't have any socials yet, but we will. That's soon. So keep an ear out for us telling you what the socials are and where you can find them.
Check the website.
They will be on the website.
Awesome stuff. Well, thank you, Dan. I'm looking forward to the next episode.
Yeah.
What have we got in store?
I'll give a little bit of a tease.
A teaser?
It's an Air New Zealand flight. And that's all I'll say.
Okay.
So, keep
going.
You know, I'll have that prepared for next episode, and we'll dive into a quite an interesting incident.
Go on the other side of the Pacific, eh?
Yep.
Awesome. Okay, yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
It's been a pleasure.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll catch you in the next episode of The Flight Files.
See you soon.